Hello and namaste. I'm Peter Furco, and this is Peter's podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. Hello, and welcome to Peter's podcast. Happy solstice, happy Kwanzaa, happy Hanukkah, happy Christmas, or whatever you appreciate this time of the year. The holidays around this time celebrate light, and today's podcast is about light's vibration. There's a link in the podcast notes to a video that shows you how vibrations move matter in beautiful ways. I head over to visit my student and co-kirtan conspirator, Lindsay Sanwald, where we talk about mantras and kirtan. But before I head out, I wanted to share something from Oprah's Super Soul podcast, which Lindsay turned me on to a while back. In Oprah's recent conversation with Sean Acor, who taught a course on happiness at Harvard University, they discuss a practice of gratitude. He's been testing this practice among many. In it, you start every day by naming three things you're grateful for. In his tests, subjects who do this for 21 days, even people who pre-tested as low-level pessimists, now test as low-level optimists. Oprah rephrased the results using her own language as, "I have found this, that gratitude changes your vibrational frequency in the world." Sean Acor replied, "That's exactly what we're finding in the research." At this time of darkness and light, I just want to say I'm grateful that you are listening to my podcast, and I wish you actual happiness and deep living. Come start the new year in the right vibration at Ishta Yoga New Year's Day. Details are in the show notes. Iggy Dean is the musical moniker of Ishta-trained yogini Lindsay Sanwald. A one-woman psychedelic rock band, Iggy Dean has been composing DIY music for 20 years, playing various instruments in multiple bands, performing solo as a looping artist across the country, and producing critically acclaimed records and music videos from her home base in Brooklyn, New York. I'm heading over there now. Talk to you from Bushwick in just a minute. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, here we are in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Yeah, drinking variety coffee and eating muffins.
Yes, in my kitchen.
In the kitchen, yeah. I just did my last podcast with Wendy in the kitchen, but we had had breakfast, so
it's
a whole different
time
of day.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but it's, you know, it's
same
still
meal.
The energy of the round table,
right,
the food.
Right, right, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah, Lindsay did a video in our kitchen last year when she was house sitting.
The kitchen was the first thing that caught my eye. She's like, I need to make something with this wallpaper.
Yeah.
This wallpaper and this orb thing, it was just, it was begging to be filled.
Yeah, that's like a mid-century modern lamp.
Yeah.
So it's good. It's good.
It's good stuff. All great ideas happen in kitchens.
In kitchens. Yeah. Parties certainly do. We were just in a nice big apartment and, of course, everybody was in the kitchen.
Yep. Gather around the food.
Yeah. So Lindsay and I are going to do a kirtan on New Year's Day.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have New Year's Day plans, most people don't because they're busy recovering from New Year's Eve.
Mm-hmm.
But we're putting it at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so that's more than enough time to recover from...
You can eat brunch.
Most things you've done on New Year's Eve.
Yeah. And I think we're kind of... I think a lot of people on New Year's Day, as pained as they might be from whatever sort of festivities they were indulging in, are really excited to like, all right, day one.
Start the year.
It's day one. How am I going to start this year?
Yeah. So we're going to have a bit of asana, just a little bit of that anybody can do.
Mm-hmm.
So no special level required. And then we'll chant in a way that lets whatever it is that you're intending for the year to have like turbocharging behind it.
Totally.
And then we'll do a little meditation to seal that all up and put you into the new year just right.
Yes. We did this last year and there were numerous people who commented on how their years unfolded thanks to the inaugural 2017 kirtan that sort of, yeah, as you said, turbocharged, yeah, intentions. So
yeah,
happy to offer it again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we're looking forward to that. And we thought that today, just to make it a little more exciting, because it's always nice when you recognize the stuff that's going on when you do any kind of a thing, whether it's going to a concert and you hear somebody whose music you already like, or in this case, doing some mantra. If you already know the mantras, then that's kind of that much more exciting to be in the vibe of it.
Yes, we're showing you the hits.
Yeah, so we're gonna walk through. Even if you're not planning to come to the kirtan, and I can't imagine why that would be the case, but just so we talk a little bit about what is this thing with mantra and this use of deities, and I'd like to start there, this, mm-hmm, notion of deity. So because we have such a sort of religious culture in America, I think often the most common use of the word deity is somebody's heard it in church or something, and they're sort of assigning that name as an alternate to God.
Mm-hmm.
And in the traditions of yoga, I mean, like where yoga became Hinduism, or other religions too, that's not far off. But what's more specific to yoga is this idea that we are energy, we have energetic component at our base, and that we can influence that energy, and that influence of energy is like its own little vortex of energy. It's like adding one energy to another. So the way you might in cooking, like, mm-hmm, if you're trying to make the perfect
omelet,
okay, you would take the ingredient that you needed to push the omelet into the direction that you had in your head as what is this omelet,
right,
going to be.
And it needs some sort of transformation and some sort of heat and technique. And
yeah.
And
so we're going to make it shift, you know. And, you know, unlike an omelet that would probably come out fine in most variations, you know, in our lives, we end up in these situations where we're out of balance and things aren't exactly going in a way that feels right. It's either feels wrong because we feel like, wait, this isn't what I'm supposed to be doing,
mm,
with my time or with my day or with my life or with this relationship or whatever. Or we don't exactly know what we're supposed to be doing, or we're doing something and it's not, we're running into some kind of an obstacle around it.
Right.
So in this case, we're using this extra ingredient to influence the energy of what we're up to make it shift into a way that's more productive,
right,
more satisfying. And in yoga, more satisfying and more productive and more successful always means you're more enlightened. When you're more enlightened, perhaps then some other things happen in a realm that, you know, the Wall Street Journal might consider successful.
Right.
But everything in yoga is really about
setting the
stage. Yeah, how do you find the truth? How do you, mm-hmm, find the depth of happiness, the contentment of whatever, with whatever comes?
Mm-hmm.
And then you move from there, and then life is successful in its richest way.
Yeah, I think, and also when it comes to the deities, I always like thinking about them. I was just having this conversation recently, how, like, I think the reason sports are so as popular as sports are is because what they effectively do is, like, set up this sort of age-old human story. There's certain boundaries to it. There's a game, there's an end zone, there's probably a ball, there's two teams.
Yeah.
And it's, like, in the midst of the game, it's like a fight of epic proportions, but
yeah,
it's always
archetypal.
Yeah, archetypal, and, like, you know the rules, and you just sort of, like, it's a way to sort of exercise. I think everything we do in this existence is we're exercising narratives.
Yeah.
So, like, a sports game is, like, a commonly known narrative that you go and you watch play out. Or I think, like, a lot of the stuff that's sort of prominent in our spiritual, our trendy even spiritual world, say, like, tarot cards and astrology, these are all just other techniques of, like, how can you shape a narrative to help kind of tell a story. And with the deities, it feels reminiscent of that before we get to the actual sort of like particulars of vibration and mantra, which is, I think, a little has a little bit more metal to it. But thinking of it as like, okay, it's not like Ganesha is a real life elephant who's coming down and stomping out obstacles, but it's like telling a child sort of a fable. It's just like, it's almost like an elephant coming exactly. down and stomping things
right.
out.
Right, and that metaphor component is huge because, as you say, we are such story-oriented creatures. You know, we do live via narrative, and having this metaphor, having this thing to, it's almost like visceral.
Yeah.
You know, when you hear about an elephant, I mean, that certainly gives you much more of a visceral reaction than thinking about obstacle
right.
or difficulty.
Yeah, these abstractions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have a classic reason for, hey, kitty.
Whoopi's joining the conversation.
Yeah.
She's her own deity.
I have purring in the last podcast because my cat decided to sit on the microphone table.
Come here, Whoopi. Last time Peter and I were outside of the studio, we were with the real Whoopi Goldberg.
Yes, that's right.
Talking about stuff of this ilk, even.
Yeah.
But
so we have this metaphorical, narrative-oriented way of making it more real.
Mm-hmm. It's like a focal point. Too.
Yeah.
It's like what can
more
you...
real, like folktales. Like it taps into that poetic aspect of your mind and
right.
the way that we think in terms of story. And then there's the energetics of it, which is that we are, you know, it's interesting. The Bhagavad Gita has this multi-layered instruction manual, basically, mm-hmm. where Krishna, who we'll speak about in a little bit, is saying, okay, so how do you live life well? How do you proceed through living without being all caught up in the stuff that isn't going to be fruitful for you, isn't going to make you happy, and how do you find instead the right way to go? And
right.
one by one, he provides methods, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the beginning ones are very abstract, and then as you proceed through, they become more like, well, but if you can't hold that in your mind because that's really hard to do, just think everything is me and do it for me.
Yeah.
You know, just think of it as doing it for a higher purpose.
Which, what we're doing tonight is kind of related to that, and I'm finding it's helping a lot. I mean, later with the just all of these other techniques of almost outsourcing your responsibility to... just an idea, and it's almost like it's actually interesting to me because it kind of points to the fact, because we do this in relationship too, how I've heard talked about how it's everybody of course is desiring their soulmate and everybody wants somebody to love, and the reason it feels so good when you're in love is because you have a focal point
yeah.
for your love
yeah.
and when you have a focal point it's like you are enlightened and
right.
you're divine because you have this one object where you can just pour all of your adoration and attention and, oh, it feels so good and easy and abundant.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, we struggle so hard to do that just for ourselves, even though that's available to us. And I just think it's in our nature that we need to always outsource. So like in the instance of love, it's outsourcing there. Or in the instance of, like, I need some help, call on the deities, or if it's just like this forever peekaboo game with ourselves, like, we don't want to honor that we have these abilities and powers and authority to change things on our own right, so we have to kind of, like, pretend, oh, Ganesha is going to take care of this,
right.
or Jesus, help me, Jesus, and
right.
somehow... there's in outsourcing it, it does get this extra power.
Yeah, well,
potentially
because the universe understands what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that I mean, you really hit it on the head there. And what's and Krishna says as much in the Gita, you know,
mm-hmm.
but. And I think that's fine. You know, like people who turn to prayer as their answer, mm-hmm. like asking for a help, asking right. for a boon, asking for the outcome they want, you know. It's a little like wishing on a genie, you know. Right. And so what I like to try to do in teaching, you know, where mm-hmm. you're trying to give people a clearer picture is like go from elementary school up to college, you yeah. know, and say, okay, so this thing that you're talking about yeah. is inside of you, right. right? So you're looking inside of you mm-hmm. for the thing that is going to make a shift in you, right. right? So in the love situation, you know, what makes us feel so wonderful about love, yeah, we're giving this other person these qualities mm-hmm. of being so great for us, mm-hmm. but we're also... we're leaving desire, right? We stop needing right. anything else except this person, right? And it's the removal of desire that makes you feel so wonderful, yeah. right? So when we're in doing mantra, it's the same thing. You're not asking some genie to please give you prosperity or right. something like that. You're saying, how do I align with myself? How do I shift this thing that's a little bit off in my own balance that makes me think I'm not prosperous, that makes me think mm-hmm. I don't have the right wisdom, that makes me think I don't have what it takes to deal with the circumstances of my life, which I'm obviously in.
Right.
And so obviously I must have what it takes to deal with them because here I am.
Right.
This is what's happening. I'll deal with it or I won't. I mean, it's going to happen yeah. whether I think I'm dealing right. with it or
so
not.
So am I going to stand in its way begrudgingly, or can I grow with the flow, or like how can I best adapt to the back and forth of, and the circumstances of any given situation?
Exactly. Yeah. yeah. So calling on the mantra is a way of focusing oneself psychologically, but because of the nature of the mantras, there's also this kind of beyond your thinking about it right. place. I was just listening to a podcast about some research on meditation, and you know, the science is doing a pretty interesting job at catching up and being able to map how different parts of your brain light up when mm-hmm. you do meditation. And there's all these connections in the frontal part of your brain that are able to make shifts between what the senses are doing and what the senses aren't doing. Mm. And so, you know, yogis experimented with all this stuff, not with fMRI machines, right. but with what does this feel like when I do it? What's the outcome when mm-hmm. I do this? So it's like very personally experiential as opposed to like what maps on a chart of blood flow.
Right.
Right. So a lot of experimentation has been done with mantra, just not in the way that science is doing experimentation now.
Right.
So these mantras have been tested and tested mm-hmm. and tested and tested and handed down and tested again, mm-hmm. and, you know, to make shifts that some part of it makes sense and some other part of it doesn't make sense, but it's still having this effect.
Yeah.
You know, so we're using them as a way to touch the deity. Mm-hmm. And the root of this word deity is light. So we're enlightening whatever is the necessary pathway to move our energy. And if you want to think about, you know, brain pathways, right. we're lighting up that particular brain pathway right. that's going to move us past whatever the challenge is or toward whatever the thing we're missing is
yeah.
that we need to see.
And I think they also, I'm just thinking, I'm rolling through my brain why I just from like an empirical standpoint, why they feel so different. And I think on one hand, it's like, all of these meditation approaches, I think one of the things that terrifies people about meditation or makes them hesitant or has them convinced that they're not doing it right or they're doing it wrong is the chatter of the mind.
Yeah.
And that they're constantly worried, well, I can't turn it off and I keep getting distracted, so I'm obviously doing it wrong. And an effective component of mantra, I think, it almost like the volume you don't, because you're you're saying sound and you're doing it repeatedly, there's not even room for your thoughts to enter.
Right.
So it's almost like drowning out the thought. And it, but it's not like a negative way. It's almost like it's, again,
well, it's a meditation technique.
Right.
Right. So it's giving a way to deal with that typical noise threshold of the mind. You know, creating this bigger signal-to-noise ratio.
Yes. And then when you sing it a certain way, and especially when you're doing it with a group, I mean, I think people who are familiar with just basic yoga classes, I don't think anybody can deny that something happens when you do the Om at the end of the class, that there's just something, or to open the class. Like, there's a shift almost immediately.
Or even at the level of a yoga class, period.
Right.
There's something very different about going to a yoga class.
Right.
Instead of practicing yourself, you still feel the shift of the energy of what's going on. You know, it encourages you more.
Right.
It pushes you more. You know, you feed off the other people's experiencing.
Back to sports, it's like you could watch the game from your TV and it's totally great, but oh my God, you're in the stadium and the crowd goes wild.
Yeah.
And it's like there's the human collective, I mean, chant.
Yeah, exactly. And there is often a chant.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, which puts you in a state of mind.
Right.
Right. So here we are working with this handful of mantras on the 1st.
Yes.
To set us into our
January
new
1st.
Year. January 1st.
2018. It's going to rule.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
I'm really excited.
Yeah. I hope you've noticed that I don't run ads for taxis or mattresses or food delivery or underwear on Peter's podcast, but here's a mini advertisement for me. An issue of Yoga Journal costs close to $10. A single yoga class in New York costs more than $20. A single private consultation with a yoga teacher can cost hundreds of dollars. I'm bringing the kind of content you would find in all those places to your phone weekly. Won't you please support me on Patreon? I'm avoiding running advertisements because I find them so annoying on the podcasts I like. I constantly am fumbling for my phone to hit the fast-forward control. But to keep my ad-free format, I need for you to value this effort. You can support the podcast at any level you like and change or stop your support whenever you want. Help me keep this an ad-free zone supported by the community of listeners like you. Go now to patreon.com/peterspodcast. There's a link right in the show notes on your phone. And thank you for listening. So you mentioned Ganesha.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll start with Ganesha. So Ganesha is this energy of breaking through obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
The narrative is a child of the gods who was killed out of anger by one of them and then found the head of an elephant to bring it back to life.
Mm.
So again, even to conquer death.
Right.
Right. So there is no obstacle that cannot be overcome.
Right. Or even childhood. I'm just reading out a childhood trauma even right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Overcoming the ultimate childhood trauma.
Habit, losing one's head.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, and in yoga, again, this notion of what is it that we're talking about? We're not talking about like Ponce de Leon living through death, but more like what is it about living that is transcendent of death? What is it that is the immortal aspect of who we are, what we are? And, you know, part of that is community and species and who we are, family. Some people relate well to family, you know, like that ongoing thing that we're not just me.
Right. There's a whole lineage and evolution even of continuation. I think we all feel it in some sense of it's not starting just with me. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants and I have my work cut out for me and I'm setting certain terrain with an either conscious or unconscious knowing that it's going to be picked up somehow.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and there's this notion of karma, you know, the Native Americans say it in this really nice way, this notion of seven generations, you know, that you are influenced by what has come and brought you here, you know?
Absolutely.
And like at seven generations back, it's literally like now it's just your DNA, you know, so DNA is like the scientific way of explaining karma.
Right.
You know, you've got certain things that you're having to deal with in life based on your physical things that are going on and your societal things that where you found yourself and your family and all of those things. And you make choices along the way as part of your own interaction with all of that.
Yeah.
So this notion of Ganesha is, you know, when I encounter an obstacle, I have in me the capacity to deal with things. There's this author I read a long time ago. He just passed away last year, I believe. And his name is Wayne Dyer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he wrote a book called Your Erroneous Zones. Yeah. And
he's in the canon of all those folks.
Yeah. And in that first book, he was kind of harping on this notion of so many people, I think it was in the 70s or early 80s he was writing, and he said, you know, the nervous breakdown is like the new thing that people are suffering from. I guess you can decide to have a nervous breakdown, or you can decide, I'm not going to have a nervous breakdown, you know, and he was talking about taking personal responsibility, which so many, you know, teachers advocate. But it's literally that, like, can I align with that part of me that's not going to say, "Ah, I have no power here."
Right, right.
But instead to say, "I do have power here. Yes. Here's what I'm capable of doing, and so I'm going to do that."
Yes, and also seeking and sensing that you are not alone in summoning that power. It's your own responsibility. But this is sort of why the concept of the deities is useful. Like, this idea, like, you're not alone. You have at least seven generations, countless more, that have sorted things out so you wouldn't have to.
Yeah.
And, like, implanted that in your mapping.
Yeah.
And so, and beyond all of that, just your animal evolution, like, you are going to, it's programmed into you. You're going to try and survive no matter what. So just sort of, again, outsourcing, like, I have to hold up everything up. It's more like you have to get out of your own way and trust that everything is there to hold you up, and you have to, it's your job and your responsibility to sort of keep your house clean and make sure that it's going to be as easy as possible to hold everything up,
right?
Because that's up to you.
Yeah. And I think one of the places many of us fall down is that we think we're not just me, but I am alone.
Right.
And so sometimes tapping the feeling of, oh, wait, I have what I need is I have other people around me who also can help.
Right.
You know? So, you know, breaking through an obstacle could be being okay with asking for help.
Right.
You know?
Totally.
Yeah. So that's Ganesha.
Yay.
I like Ganesha.
Ganesha's great.
Yeah.
So striking.
Our teacher, Alan Finger, uses him to get parking spots too.
I was gonna bring up the parking spot. Yeah, there's yeah. I've tried it once or twice.
Yeah,
it can work. It can work.
So moving on through a random sort of order of things.
I feel like we have like a bingo ball.
Yeah.
We're just pulling out deities.
Next, because we have to go off to some event in a little while. So
we're good. You're like,
yeah. Oh, great. I have to translate from beats or measures to time.
Oh, I can just fix that.
Lakshmi's next. Lakshmi.
Love her.
Gotta love her. She's love, you know? I mean, Lakshmi is that part of mother that is the provider. You know, anything you need.
She's got you.
Yeah. And everything that's come, everything that is, what Mother Nature.
Right.
In its abundance.
Yes. I found, when I was recently on retreat and I was trying to meditate on abundance and, you know, calling on Lakshmi to help, et cetera. But what it helped me sort of see, and which felt so, this was so Lakshmi, was being out and about, and we're so attached to this one little entity called money. We're like, oh, yes. Abundance is money, and I don't either have it or I don't, and blah, 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 blah. And learning that, like, abundance in money is just one component, literal currency of that energy, and that it's actually so many more things, and a way in which felt very Lakshmi-esque to sort of like practice that was thinking, oh my God, I have so much air to breathe. Mm-hmm. Like, I have limitless air to breathe, or mm-hmm. I could turn on this faucet right here and just drink as much water or waste as much water as I want. I have so much water. I have so much water and air.
Yeah.
And I have everything I need. And you see it in nature, just, you know, the tree's not like, how many people do I need to feed? I'm going to make that many peaches.
Right.
The tree just makes a ton of peaches.
Yeah.
And some fall and die, and that's totally fine.
Yeah.
And some get harvested, and some never get picked. But the point is, like, it is so abundant.
Right. Yeah.
Lakshmi.
And that's the nature of the world.
Yeah.
You know, and there are places that are challenging, like, you know, the desert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the desert 300 years ago was hard to get by in the desert, but you could always leave the desert. I mean,
yes.
You know, not everyone could, but... You know, you figure out how do you live within that, and then you find the abundance that's in that.
Right. And then if you live in 2017, you go to Burning Man and live in the desert.
Yes.
And live without a money currency economy and see how that works.
And bring stuff with you.
And
I just
really
heard
learn
that,
to appreciate water.
Yes.
And shade.
I heard that in Utica, they have their own money.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's good, like, for them.
So that they spend within their community.
Well, it's interesting, not to go off on a super tangent, but even all these, like, cryptocurrencies coming about
mm-hmm.
to sort of redefine money, because we always forget, like, it's totally meaningless, the
yeah,
actual
made up.
Fabric of it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just it's a system of, you know, outside of, yes, we have responsibilities to pay for certain things, and things cost money, and there's, you know, that stuff, but it's all so abstract. I mean,
yeah.
How is a dollar bill any different from even us just talking about Lakshmi? It's another sort of like symbol,
right.
Mover, shaker,
right.
Of how to
right.
ride
it's,
this wave.
Yeah, symbol of some kind of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, finding your relationship with Lakshmi is to come to that kind of understanding. And it's not even, you know, I mean, there are a great deal of practices that are... more along the realm of mindfulness, of like noticing that this is possible, almost like affirmation.
Right.
Right. And those are really valuable. And what's cool about working at the vibrational level is that you start to make shifts mm-hmm. that predate the mind.
Right. Right? And
they,
language.
Yeah. They shift you fundamentally.
Right.
Toward the right energy, toward the right perspective. So they can be useful even when you are having trouble buying it
right.
from the mental place, right?
Yeah.
Oh, how am I going to do it? I don't have the right job and, you know, this and that. But the mantra will often shake you up in
right.
such a way that the job appears,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's Lakshmi.
Because even... in the practice of it, again, you're at least for a moment replacing those thoughts, quieting those thoughts by
right.
or by doing, you know, the chant. And it's inevitable, again, whether you buy it or not, it's at least allowing you to think abundance. This is, I'm chanting some words or that mean abundance.
Yeah.
So it's like, I was going to say meditative, but it's almost like medicinal. Like it's...
It is like medicinal.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like there's... You know, mantra works at those multiple levels.
Right.
It has a psychological component if you know what the mantra means,
mm-hmm.
but you don't have to know what the mantra means because it also has that medicinal component.
Right.
Like there's this wonderful video that you can look up. I'll put a link in the show notes that shows when you just blow a single tone, it creates like a geometry.
Yes.
A vibration. And as you change the tones, the geometry changes. So
right.
as we chant... we're interacting with ourselves at that vibrational level,
mm-hmm.
making those kinds of changes.
Yeah.
So related to Lakshmi is Saraswati,
mm-hmm.
another component of the goddess
Trinity.
Yeah. And in where Lakshmi was about abundance in the material realm, Lakshmi is about an abundance of understanding.
Saraswati.
Saraswati, about abundance in the
wisdom,
understanding mm-hmm. realm, that you are inspired.
Mm.
And in that, the word inspired, you know, we think of it as like, how do I make something creative,
mm-hmm.
you know, or how do I like figure out a new solution to something, you know? But inspiration is literally the natural state of being in the world and also being transcendent of the world.
Right.
So the inspiration is the part of being transcendent of the world and knowing that as you're in the world, right? So when you're inspired, it's because when you're inspired in the, you know, the more traditional mundane sense, right. it's because you're connected with who you are
right.
beyond your mundane existence.
Right. And it's like a flood.
Yeah.
Again, it feels like abundant.
Wonderful.
And it's like those stroke of insights. I love where they're born. I think we've talked about how my favorite photograph is, or one of my favorite photographs is of the guy who, did we talk about this the last, I think we talked about this in the last podcast. So. The guy who wrote Hamilton, there's a picture of him just laying in a hammock on vacation, reading a book about Hamilton. And I just love it so much because I'm just like, that's how things get born, when you are quiet. And you're not trying to like, I'm going to write the next best Broadway show.
Right.
No, I'm going to chill out in this hammock by the water and read a fun book.
Yeah.
And that's where it's going to come. Or if I'm just like in the shower or driving or doing the dishes, like these sort of artist brain modes that allow lightning to strike.
Right. And what they're doing is they're stopping the mundane mind from doing its constant flood of chatter so that this natural other part of you can be there.
Right.
And we call it inspire because, or inspiration or lightning bolt or something, because we're so rarely quiet enough for it to be there. It's always there.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So chanting to Saraswati is to align yourself with that connection.
Yes.
So that you have that connection all the time.
Yeah.
Right, so that when you are in a situation, you get out of your own way and you act from the inspired place.
From a wisdom position too, which just carries this weight of just like a much more profound knowing and sort of confidence that it's something quite substantial. I'll play Saraswati chants days of my shows. It's like one of my traditions, rituals.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good point too. You know, like when you resonate with a particular mantra, it's great to have that around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a line in the Yoga Sutras that says, through your own studies, you will find the Ishta Devata, that ray of light, that vibration that will connect you to your understanding self, your self that's in right relationship with life.
Right.
You know? So when you do come across something, you know, you find, oh man, Saraswati really does it for me, you know, bring it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also just like her because, you know, she plays guitar.
She's cool.
She's cool.
She plays the vina.
She's like always reading literature and
she is
shredding.
Literature. Yeah, I know. She's the bomb.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's the artist. What do you call that? Not a mascot, but what's that word?
That works.
Yeah. But mascot implies something smaller. She's the...
deity.
She's the deity. Yes, exactly. She's the god.
Yeah.
Who else we got? Krishna. Oh, we mentioned Krishna. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Krishna. So Krishna is, I always make a joke when we're doing our kirtans about, you know, Hare Krishna and what a funny kind of relationship the Hare Krishna movement has in our contemporary culture.
Yeah, right around the corner from Ishta too.
Yeah. And you know, the Hare Krishna practice came in the 60s, and even the Beatles got into it.
Right.
You know, but this deity Krishna is the knowing how to live life. Mm-hmm. How do you live life? Like I said, he's the giver of the wisdom in the Bhagavad Gita. He's
right.
telling the warrior Arjuna, how should you live?
Right.
So the Krishna is this, okay, life is really complicated.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to deal with this? The world seems really unsatisfying. As the Buddha said, life is suffering.
Right.
What am I supposed to do about this?
Yeah.
Right. So Krishna is the bearer of the understanding. And again, in a more mundane or classical religious sort of way of thinking about that, we think, okay, so we go read a Bible or we go read the Bhagavad Gita, and that's mm-hmm. how we learn that. But in fact, we can, in a more tantric way, align with our whole self.
Right.
And when you're aligned with your whole self and you experience yourself in this wholeness, oneness, mm-hmm. then when you come back into your regular living and you look at someone else, you're them.
Right.
You are them.
Right.
Why you would never mistreat them.
Right.
You know, when you're looking for what should I do with this decision in front of me, you tap into your wholeness mm-hmm. and you go, well, of course I should do this. This is the one that feels right.
Right.
And so everything becomes a natural expression. Because you are Krishna, you are
right.
tapped into the understanding, right. you know, you're living for Krishna.
Right.
You're living for the right, in Buddhism, they call it Dharma,
right.
right living.
Yeah. There's also this, I always associate, at least in the Gita, like this stoicism about Krishna, where, you know, Arjuna really doesn't want to go to war because he's like, well, isn't the right thing to do not to kill other people?
Yeah.
And Krishna sort of stoically lays it down. He's like, yeah, but you're a warrior. I mean, no, the game's on.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you ready for some football? Like, go fight.
Right, right, right.
And sort of like, it's, there's nothing that's not gonna, it's like how you think you can just prevent death and prevent everything. It's not like that. It's
right.
How do you play gracefully in this life that you're beholden to, like, so
that your DNA has placed you
that in, you're here,
circumstances yeah. and everything else.
Yeah,
there's, this is your karma.
Exactly.
This is your dharma.
There's did you see the City of Lost Z, that movie?
City of Lost
Z.
No,
it was an airplane. I think it was like a big release, but I got to watch it on an airplane recently, and I like it's based on a true story of this explorer going through the Amazon, and he goes on all these trips, and on his final, spoiler alert for anybody who wants to see, mute the next second.
La 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 la.
So the last scene is he's on this, he gets captured by like natives with his son, and it becomes very clear that they're probably going to be victim to like cannibalism and their death. And he again, very sort of stoically looks at his son. He's like, nothing can happen to us that wasn't our destiny.
Yeah.
Like this, if this is what's going to befall us, like, this is what we've been waiting our whole lives to do.
Yeah.
So just chill.
Yeah.
And walk bravely into your life.
Yeah. And you'll see what's next.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. Krishna.
Yeah. But, you know, the stoicism, it's like a fine line because then this notion of, what's a good example of that? Some people think they don't deserve anything, or they think they're supposed to not live or not do mm-hmm. anything, or they don't deserve anything, or, you know, and you get into that like Calvinist kind of a thing. So there's degrees of that, like stoicism about not wanting what is happening to be happening
mm-hmm.
is different from being stoic in a way of denying oneself,
right.
which is more in line with the Stoics of the
right.
Greek times.
Right.
Right. So, yeah. So Krishna isn't so much a Ten Commandments kind of a person
right.
as a go forth
right.
and do without being attached to the outcome.
Right.
Just like your buddies from the movie,
mm-hmm.
you know, you just go.
And also being kind of loving about it, being like, if that's really hard for you to do, that's okay. Just think of me.
Yeah,
I
yeah,
got
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And make everything devoted to me, and therefore you kind of, I'll help take some of the burden away.
Right. Right. Yeah, like one's highest.
Right.
Self, highest.
Mm-hmm.
Notion of self, even. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's Krishna. And then Rama is in that same Hare Krishna chant. And Rama is just an earlier version of the same thing.
Mm. His seventh generation ancestor.
Yeah. From when it wasn't so much about, like, how am I supposed to live in this, but when life was a little bit more chaotic in general, like, how do we organize society to be a little bit more civilized and a little less savage.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Right. So that's the Rama component of that.
Kali?
Kali. So Kali, such an important energy, and it goes with this stoicism component that we were just talking about, because Kali is the aspect of the mother, that provider, that everything you would need, whether it's material goods or understanding. In Kali, it's what you also need is to not be so focused on me, me, me.
Right. Yeah. So, lose your head, literally.
Yeah. So Kali is the get rid of this attachment to myself, my ego, my me being the important thing in all of this, my experience being the only experience there is. So that as you align yourself with Kali, you're being ruthless, right? So related to that stoicism, you're being ruthless about when you're starting to get too full of yourself, which sometimes that's in a boastful way, but sometimes it's in a like a depressed way, you know, like oh, woe is me kind of way.
Right.
Right. So again, Kali can come in and say, no, not woe is you. You know, you're divine.
Yeah.
Right? You just gotta look at the light. Take your hand away from your eyes.
Yeah.
You know, take the mirror away and see the brilliance beyond that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And she's also doesn't she also kind of work with these notions of time?
Yeah, that she's literally the ruler of time.
Yeah, and time being in and of itself sort of a destroyer.
Yeah.
A
destroyer of the individual stories that we're living through this mundane aspect. I keep using mundane, and I don't want to make it sound
negative.
Like it's a
no,
negative.
Yeah.
But the
everyday.
Sensory world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the, you know, that part of us that isn't whole or isn't big, like our families, even our families at the smallest unit, right?
Yeah.
They go on for eons.
Yes.
Right? So that's going on, and our individual component of it is so small, you know, like
And think of all that's going to come from us too, you know?
Yeah. And then the, you know, even if you just look at a star chart or something.
Right.
We're like a little dot on a little dot.
On a little
by
dot
a little
on a little
star
dot. Yeah.
In a giant galaxy in the universe.
Just
you know?
Cells in a body.
Yeah. So, and yet we get so wrapped up in the importance of our every thought about, you know, what's happening to us.
Right.
So Kali is, you know, a shifter.
Yeah.
That makes you say, get away from that. Get away from that part.
I always think of, I don't think I've ever voiced this, but I always think of this when I'm thinking about Kali, is the Moonstruck when Cher slaps the dude and is like, snap out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's like Kali.
She's she's the slap out of it. The chop off your head, the slap you in the face.
Get with the program, snap out of it.
Yeah, yeah. The stomp you in your chest, and so you know, aligning with that energy can make you make significant changes, which is why there are always warnings about chanting to Kali, because something big is going to happen. But what's going to happen is your life is going to realign with a much better direction.
Right.
You know? So I don't really worry about that, even though it might come as a surprise to somebody when their life makes a turn for the better.
Right.
I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that shift. Yes. No.
Yeah.
And as teachers, part of our job is to hold the space for those kinds of changes. Mm-hmm. So somebody can have a transformation and feel safe doing it.
Right.
You know, and which I is why even, it's good to work with teachers.
Yes. And I think even, I mean, it's not like these are being, it's not like they're curses or spells.
Right.
It's you are driving the machine in like a supervised arena.
Right.
It's like a goat. And so in some sense, you're, and that, this is again further testament to your own incantatory power, where just by virtue of saying it, you are signaling that I want to shift something here.
Yeah.
For the better. And so inviting that in.
Right. Right. And, you know, if you feel like I want it to come in, but I don't want it to mess up my, you know, job, relationship, finances, whatever, you know.
It surfs up.
Something will come about. Either the mantra won't do anything because you're denying it at the same time you're asking for it, or the resources and the support that you need to make it okay will come up too.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and so in the best way of working with mantra personally, you know, it's a little bit like a prescription or a little cocktail of vibrations.
Yes.
So that it's tuned to all the aspects of what you need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah.
I mean, and like we, I think we typically do this in session, but you can, anybody can hear it when instruments are tuning in an orchestra or someone's tuning a guitar. There's the off and then there's the on, and it's really, all of this is just about getting tuned.
Yeah, it is. Working in your optimum.
Right. The guitar is going to play so much more beautifully.
Yeah.
The instrument is going to play so much more beautifully if it's in tune, unless you're Sonic Youth. And you're intentionally keeping it out of
exactly. But but that's a good point too, because we get these ideas in our head about what it means to be successful, what it means to be good enough, what it means to be doing it right, and we think of ourselves like a whole bunch of guitars. Where it's just a guitar, and I'm going to be like the good guitars.
Mm-hmm.
But we're a kind of instrument that each one of us is a different instrument.
Right.
So that when we're tuned up, we're ringing in our own unique way, and it's the orchestra of all of us together that is the community of humanhood.
Opera.
Yeah.
The opera of life.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the work of it.
Yeah. So,
who we got? Shiva Shakti?
Shiva Shakti. We'll wrap with Shiva Shakti.
Yeah.
So Shiva Shakti is like an overarching.
Mm-hmm. It's like the moon sun.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah. As the yin yang is to that Taoist philosophy, the Shiva Shakti is to Tantra, that it's everything.
Right.
That it's the consciousness and the reflection of the consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was just listening to someone talk about mindfulness, and they were speaking of awareness of awareness, right? That in a mindfulness practice, you might pay attention to your thinking,
right?
Watch your thoughts.
Yeah.
And when you become aware that you're thinking, that's like a level of awareness, like meta awareness, right? And the Shiva Shakti is like, take that up to the level of the galaxy and the universe we were just talking about. It's the awareness and the thing that's created by that awareness, the everything that is, and the awareness of everything that is, you know. And we become very engrossed in the everything that is,
right?
The stuff,
right?
And when we're that, we're only half of the yin yang,
right?
We're only half of the who we are. And when we're only half of who we are, it's very hard to be contented.
Yeah,
you don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Things don't seem to make sense.
Yeah, it's so, always a sense of missing.
Yeah, so we need to tap into the understanding of it. We need to incorporate that. It's the same as the inspiration thing we were talking about earlier. You need to allow the connection to that part of what we are in order to have our whole knowing available, so that when we're going through life, we have this inspiration working through us. Right? And, you know, then we get into these weird disconnects, these abstractions that are kind of like Shiva, kind of like the knower, the observer, the
hypercerebral
intelligence, right? Without really understanding
what's at hand.
The Shakti, the stuff. And this gets to the big challenge that's going down and this big awakening of the Me Too, right? It's like, wait a minute, I didn't know I was doing that.
Yeah.
Well, why not?
Yeah.
Because you were disconnected.
Right.
You know? So there are imbalances in both regards.
Right.
Right. And at the level of these gigantic words we're talking about, Shiva and Shakti, I mean, these are like the fundamental division of everythingness into coming into beingness.
Right.
But there's a microcosmic expression of those things through everything in denser and denser and denser expressions all the way down, so that you can be looking for the balance in everything,
right?
Including in a relationship you're having with a coworker.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, totally. As Shiva Shakti, it's almost like it's so massive. It's trickier to talk about, or it's very easy to just veer off into just obvious duality. But a thing that keeps coming up in my mind is relating it to like the Apollo Dionysus idea of, I keep thinking of like a painter with a painting, and there's this painting that exists on canvas and the painter who painted it, but then what the real sort of like happening is sort of the in between of what is the observation of the painting. And that in-between is sort of like the glue that brings these two elements together, where there's the seeing, the recognition, the sort of like mental reception, and even, I don't even know if reception is the right word, almost like, because it feels more like pointed, like mental articulation of like a visual. But then the visual is just the pure Shakti creation of it. But it's only, but this, then you start seeing sort of like the yin yang of it, where it's like that, it's that creativity that sort of, it came out of the Shiva effort, and then there it is on the canvas. But without it being there on the canvas, then the painter directed at it and creating it doesn't really
Can't separate them.
You can't, that's
what's so
to get at,
beautiful
yeah.
is that once you start trying to pull it apart, you see you can't have one without the other,
right?
That everything that is manifest has the intelligence in it.
Right.
And the intelligence is nothing without the manifestation, which is why the, in the way of describing, you know, in the philosophy of this, there's like the desire for manifestation, and immediately there is the Shiva and Shakti.
Right.
that is the split. There mm-hmm. must be something to experience, and there must be an experiencing, mm-hmm. experiencer,
yeah.
so to speak. You know? But it's not they're not a separate.
Right. And that's why when we have these moments where it's such a thrill, because you have that sort of glimpse of the two coming together again, which is, of course, the state that it is, but that sort of fit feel of, oh, right, this is the whole cosmic dance gel of these two forces.
Exactly. And, you know, it's funny because last week, there was a week back, because you come to meditation class, this is my meditation class on Saturdays, and you didn't come to one, and I did this Shiva Shakti.
Oh, damn. I was in Jersey City.
Yeah. But I mentioned the mantra, the way we do it in the kirtan, where it goes, sure. Shiva Shakti Om,
mm-hmm.
right? Because in the creation of this division, this, like, creating the observer and the observed, you end up with Om,
right.
which is the vibrational thing that is what we've been talking about this whole podcast,
yeah.
right? Us as vibration.
Yeah.
So Shiva Shakti makes that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So. It's like, it's also the music. When you think about music, it's a play. You can already sense the wave where there's silence and then there's noise, and it's sort of the dance between the two that makes it evident.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So
yeah,
come to the kirtan. Yay.
Om. Namaste, Lindsay.
Namaste, Peter.
That's our holiday episode of Peter's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I look forward to season 2. I'm very excited about my summer retreat with Ulrika Norbury, Wendy Newton, in Normandy, France, this summer, August 14 to 18. It's called Yoga and the Art of Living Creatively. Details are available at peterfurco.com/France2018. A link is also in the show notes. I'm also headed to the Caribbean for Easter to do a retreat with Petra Reckbrand. Details also on my website. I'm teaching a 300-hour teacher training at Ishta in January. I also teach regular asana and meditation classes there. See ishtayoga.com for details. And finally, I'm using Patreon to offer opportunities to work with me one-on-one. You can subscribe for a mantra session or for an hour video private. Of course, you can also subscribe at any level you like, just because you enjoy listening to Peter's podcast and you want to keep it ad-free. Check out patreon.com/peterspodcast. And I keep mentioning the show notes in case you're not sure what those are. These are the paragraphs on the page for each podcast episode on your app, or if you're listening on the computer, on your iTunes. Links in those paragraphs will send you to the various things that I mention in the podcast. Hope you're enjoying. Take care. See you next year. Namaste.